So I'm out and about the other day, down at the ocean. It's this gray, overcast day, and I'm walking through Golden Gate Park. I'm looking at things. And it suddenly occurs to me as I'm looking at things, and it was actually this one tree that had some kind of flowering thing. Although it was weirder than a flower. It was like an elaborately ornate ornamental stem thing. Anyway, the leaves are sort of hanging there, and the tree is sort of hanging there. And then I see these tendrils, these flower-esque tendrils, sort of shooting straight up, very clearly going up in the up direction. And when we think about the relationship between, you know, things going up and things going down, and it's funny the way we've cast things as, you know, gravity is this primal force that pulls things down. Everything tends towards that. When all I could do is really look at the world and see that that's just not the case, right? Things go in all kinds of directions. Gravity is a steady force for sure. I mean, there's a pull of objects. Objects are related to each other. There's all kinds of things going up, up, up. It seems, you know, life goes up. But then what I was thinking about thinking about how thinking about that was transforming my body. I began to just literally see things, right? And I begin to see forces coming up from the ground and forces coming down, and I begin to see a whole distributive scheme of flows. And next thing you know, of course, I'm thinking about, you know, two popular images, you know, from the cinema. One is, you know, Keanu Reeves in The Matrix, Neo, at the end of the first one, you know, where he sees the code all of a sudden, you know, and he just whoops the agent's asses, and he's just, everything's that green code. And we see a similar notion in Lucy, Luc Besson's really terrible film, where Scarlett Johansson, you know, she's using more and more of her brain, and she begins to see the tendrils, she begins to see connections, she sees other things happening. When I'm thinking this idea of things going up, a force of things going up, what's actually happening in that moment is I'm looking for a kind of code. I'm looking for what Neo sees, and I'm looking for what Scarlett Johansson sees, Lucy sees. The difference, though, is that they see, the idea is that they see some primal thing. They see past the bullshit. For me, it's really different. I see all these possibilities of how things can be distributed. And as I'm thinking that, I'm really, I feel it in this image in my brain, but it's an image that moves down through my cells and out through my body, and I suddenly see everything, including my body and the flowers and the earth and the suns and the leaves and the dust blowing, and I see all these forces and I see them all distributing themselves. My point in telling you that is not to have a theory or proper theory of gravity or levity or ebullience or whatever you want to call this upward force. I'm talking about the sensuality and the kind of erotics, I'll suggest, of understanding. Of seeing these things, that when I am thinking this idea, my body is all a flutter. I'm inundated from the inside outwards and the outside in, right? It's this empirical moment. It's a moment of mutual becoming, I suppose, you know, to sound sort of douchey and pretentious, but it's this, it feels good, you know? And this is what kind of interests me, right? And the way that understanding something, thinking something, the way thought itself is so palpable, so sensual, so erotic, so ingrained in the flesh of things, most clearly, or most, not most clearly, most palpably, the body, my body, not the body, my freaking body, and I suppose yours. Understanding is a sensual activity, right? I mean, to understand an idea you did not have before, is, in a sense, to be occupied. You can see how we think about ideas almost as viruses, and we get to the meme. Burroughs talks about language as a virus. You can see the kind of occupation that a virus makes in my body, in one's body. And to me, that, you know, it changes the whole sort of pedagogic milieu, right? It's not this thing where you're not trying to teach and or learn, you know, through this abstract moment of clarity. It's not like, oh, I see something. It's like, yes, you see something, but it's pervasive, right? Understanding is pervasive. It works the body over. It has a kind of right. I left that moment in there just because it really came at this fantastic time, because I'm trying to talk about the physicality, the sensuality, the worldliness of thinking, and the way of thought really comes to occupy the body, and then sometimes it sort of leaves, right? And right then, I really experienced this relationship between an idea I was having, and then all of a sudden it got very sort of vague, and I couldn't see it, and to lose an idea, to understand an idea, but lose a train of thought. We talk about this often. We do, to lose a train of thought. This is a familiar figure. But think about it for a moment. It's incredible. You're sort of following your whole, you're going down a path. It's almost like a story, a film. It's almost like a narrative. I don't even know why I say it's almost. It is. It is a film. Film is thought. Thought is film. It is all these moving bodies, and you're with them, and you're with them, and then all of a sudden you're like, what? What? And the relationship between the thought, the body, the image, the flow, which is the flow of the language itself, is expression. You can't separate expression. It's not that I couldn't find the words. It's not that I couldn't find the words. That I couldn't find the idea. I couldn't find the idea of the idea of an idea occupying my body to find, to be this certain expression of words. That was that moment. It was... It's the reason I didn't edit that out. I played with that for a moment, and it felt ridiculous. But this is actually really what interests me right now. And thinking about the way, talking about the way, expressing the way, thought, thinking, understanding, having an idea occupy you, takes you over and inflects the entire world and reaches out to the world and the world back to you. To understand an idea that you've never understood, which is what understanding is, right? I mean, that's the moment. You understand an idea means I didn't. It was nothing before. It was a series, a smattering, if you will, of affects and concept and meaning, but it didn't quite come together, it didn't cohere. When you understand, it takes on a shape, it takes on a coherence that begins to occupy your body, vision, as well as the world. It's an idea, and the understanding of an idea is this movement from the idea and the world coming to shape in and of my body, inflected with and through my body, then back out through the world. Right? So understanding becomes a cog within a very worldly operation. Thinking is not separate from the world. It's not this other thing. It's not the sin. It's not overthinking. It's not thinking too much. You know, thinking is in and of itself a sensual enterprise. The trick, I suppose, is to see it as such, and to live it as such, and experience it as such, to think it as such. And I suppose one reason I've sort of had a problem with academics is when I would read their prose, or even interact with them, to be perfectly honest, I wasn't sure things were being thought through. I think there was almost a fidgeting, What is that thing? What is that difference I'm trying to explain between a sort of veneer of thought versus a kind of thorough palpability of thought? I don't want to set up that kind of figure of a proximity to a truth. That's not my point at all. Maybe they're just different modes of thinking. Maybe, you know, this whole discussion can be bereft of judgment and just be about different modes of thought. And that I never really enjoyed academic thought because it really leaves the body behind. It leaves the erotic behind. I mean, come on, guys, look at the... I don't even get into the rules around what governs, you know, the erotic in the academy. You know, academia doesn't want that, which is fine. You know, it's akin to the monastery, right? I mean, the academy is the inheritance of the monastery. It's just not my thing. Thinking for me is palpable. It's sensual. It's physical. And I think there's something incredible about that moment when you let an idea occupy you and it takes you back outside yourself to let you see the world in these variegated ways, in these inflected ways. That's what I always loved about survey classes, and seeing all these different, you know, models of interpretation, these different theories. You go from Foucault to Derrida to Deleuze, Bergson, you know, I guess Heidegger, Hegel, Kant. I love just occupying their space and seeing the world that way. And certain things could take hold more or less, you know. And I read a lot of Hegel. I did exams on Hegel for my doctorate, and it never really stuck. I just didn't. It ran through me, right? It was like a meal I didn't want to eat. It was like both stuck and running through me alternately, right? It was like colitis. Not that I didn't enjoy it. It's just that gives you the wrong impression. It's just that it didn't sit well with me. That phrase I love. I love that phrase. It didn't sit well with me. Kant, I've known Kant, and I can see that mode of operation. But it didn't titillate me, right? And certainly, you know, I read Foucault, and I was really like, it really changed my life. I was really just moving with this certain sensuality of thought. I mean, that's what Foucault really introduces. And he's not the only one who introduces it, but really performs. And of course, everybody has a different sensuality. People might find a sensuality in Kant. That's just not my sensuality. What I'm trying to talk about overall is the way thinking is this inflection of the body, this digestive, metabolic gesture that you take in and it comes back out, and it's the system of operation of taking in the trees and the leaves, and I see these things shooting up, and I have these visions. I see it all the way through. I see the way everything becomes inflected, redistributed. I suddenly see gravity as the narrative, as a narrative. And I say, okay, what if I can take that narrative of gravity as the sort of dominant bully pulling things down, and I can shift it. I can shift it and say, no, gravity is this sort of playful imp who, you know, provides this blanket along the surface of large bodies or the surface of all bodies, but then plays with this other force, ebullience or levity that wants to move up and out, and then magnetism, which pulls things together at different angles, not just, you know, I think magnetism in a way supersedes gravity. You know, gravity is a kind of magnetism, but it's a directional magnetism. The point being sort of two things: to see and think the world is to distribute it in these certain ways, but those ways, and this is really the related second point, involve your body, involve a kind of occupation, a kind of inhabiting, all right, of your skin, just taking over, and this leaking out, and it's not just hegemonic; it's generous because it's showing you this way. Look at it this way. look at, understand Kant's imperative and categorical imperative, and you see things this way, and you see Hegel's dialectic this way, and you know, Deleuze and Guattari's rhizome, and all of a sudden the world shifts again, and I feel my whole body shift with it, and certain things sit better with my body, and I see them. And then sometimes I see the world, and it's not just I'm reading a book, it's that I see the world. I see the world, and it, it's not just a thisness. There's also a thisness, which interests me. But there's a thisness, which is a thatness, which is a whole mode of operation. Okay, let me give you an example, because that sounds abstract. I talked about this a long time ago, over Christmas, but it was Christmas Day, and I like to spend Christmas alone, and I'm in Golden Gate Park, and it's 11 a.m. or something, and it's crisp, cool, sunny day. It was beautiful here, and I'm looking at the buffalo. There's a paddock of buffalo in the middle of Golden Gate Park in San Francisco, and I'm looking at these buffalo, and I suddenly saw with utter clarity, with that reverberation, that sensual understanding, that how the cow, and you can see the relationship between the buffalo to the cow, so give me that, how the cow is considered a sacred animal in some places to some people. I see that. And then I look up and I see these hawks moving about, and I see that they're forming a kind of system. I see they're hunting, they're parsing the land, these two of them working in tandem, looking, hunting, swooping down, looking for the shadows, the flicker of grass, looking for the movement of small rodents they can snatch up and eat. And I'm seeing these two things. I'm seeing these cow buffalo, and I'm seeing these animals of prey, these birds of prey, and I see how the Egyptians can worship the cat and that will, and I see a whole world of knowledge echoing out, rippling out from this will to be cat, from this cat becoming, and then I also see an entire will, an entire knowledge religion, an entire epistemology, an entire science coming from the cow, and I see these two different worlds happening. It's a narrative happening that then enfolds me as its thinker, as its understander, right? As this inflection point within the trajectory of this idea that moves through the world, through the ether, and through my body. What, pray tell, is my point, you ask? Well, back to the idea of the thisness, you know. I'm out, I'm seeing these buffalo, and I'm seeing the whole history of thought and the formation of religions and the modes of ethical interactions and how cultures become with the cow versus the bird of prey versus the cat. And then down the ocean, and I'm seeing these waves, the sky and the curvature of the earth, and I'm just presence. There's a thisness. And we all know this, right? And you see the wave swell, and I'm like, oh my God, look at the swell of the wave. I have nothing else to offer. The thought doesn't go anywhere else. It's just the pure presence of that moment. It's a hecate. It's an insistence of the world happening. Just that it's happening. That it's happening, that it has this inflection, that perfect swell. And watching a wave begin to build and then build and build and then begin to break, and that swell right there. It's just incredible. But it's different. It's different than having a thought like the buffalo as a ideal of wisdom and human becoming, and seeing how that pervades human experience over millennia. Both those are modes of engagement. Neither is privileged. They're both very, very beautiful and both very, very sensual, worldly. When I say sensual, sensuous, right? They're of this world. And no doubt, I love the moment where I don't want to speak and I'm just filled with the wonder and smulty, huge splendor of oceanic becoming with beneath, within, with the sky. But I also love that moment of thinking, seeing things shooting up and wondering about the narratives of gravity and knowledge and how things all interact and all these things. It's another kind of flow, right? I mean, that insistent moment of thought, of thisness, is a kind of insistence. It's metabolic too, it's worldly too, and it's pervasive too. It's just this, and it's a following of the physicality, the sensuality of that wave. But when I see things moving up rather than down, when I see buffalo as a form of knowledge distinct from the way of the bird of prey, that too is enjoying the swell of the wave, but it's the wave of thinking rather than the wave of the ocean. And those things operate differently, and they're both beautiful, and they're both of this world, and they're both as true and interwoven with the very fabric and of the world, man. Yeah. So the point is, thinking is of the world as much as experience is, because thinking is an experience.